For all of you out there, I want to welcome you to the very first of the new format of the CWF Gamecast. This is our new conversational format, and it marks the beginning of episodes starring myself, but of course my co-host, Tom Barbalay. Tom?
Jonathan, it's a pleasure to be on this podcast.
I'm very excited to have you on here, and I think this is going to be a good way to do the podcast. I think having a conversation allows there to be more growth and to explore things more in depth and just kind of see where things go.
Certainly, certainly. Well, should we start talking about your past week in wargaming, or do you want me to start?
How about you start us off?
Okay, well, I'm currently writing my own rule set, so for folks who've listened into our Stone Ape recording, should I say, I did touch a little bit on that. But part of the background to the rule set is to do with guerrilla warfare and various kind of survival elements. And I've been studying the Yugoslav and Chechen conflicts recently because I think they provide some example of at least European, relatively modern European theatres. And Chechnya in particular, I think, lends itself to kind of small skirmish war games. So I've been exploring various rule set possibilities, and when in doubt, also offering my own interpretations on that. So initially, that's just a lot of reading, some mathematics, some probability testing. But yeah, that's really, I guess, what I've been doing in the past week, aside from the fact that, as I mentioned also in the Stone Ape podcast, a co-worker used to run a game store, and he has a lot of inventory. And if I'd been smart enough, I would have brought down the miniatures that he passed on to me today. But he passed on some amazing, I think they were Peter Pig and another set of 28mm First World War miniatures, mainly UK. But yeah, really kind of, I guess, 1980s style 28mm, so slightly smaller, slightly shrunken 28mm. But some beautiful figures in there that I'm going to have to be painting in the near future. So that's been my week.
It sounds like you've been very busy.
I fit a lot in the evenings. I think probably similar to you, I'm a bit of a night owl, and I really look forward to kind of luxurious evenings of reading, writing, and just generally planning. So my evenings tend to be the time that I can immerse myself in this kind of stuff.
That's good. You're right. I do like to stay up fairly late. Not as late as I used to. Getting up to be into work for 9 ends up being a bit of a hassle sometimes. But I find I'm actually most productive later in the evening. I don't know if you feel that's true with you as well.
I think, time is just a luxury. And I think the kind of stuff that I like doing in the late evening, particularly the kind of reading I like doing, I probably wouldn't do, you know, on a weekend first thing in the morning or these kind of things. So I think everything has a time, place, and certainly I've also been reading an interesting book on strategy recently. Again, if I had planned this out, probably I would have the book in front of me. But it was a historical strategy book from a fellow who was a retired British general, I want to say, and fascinating accounts of periods and histories that I've been reading progressively too. So in terms of your week in wargaming, have you been doing much reading or painting or assembling or playing? What have you been doing?
I've been doing a little of everything. It doesn't feel that I've been very busy, but looking back and thinking about it, it's been jam-packed. Early in the week, I had worked a little bit on painting some of my Flames of War minis, and as people who've listened to the podcast and read the blog and hopefully listened to my appearance on the Stone Ape cast know, I not only hate assembling and painting, but I think I'm awful at it. So getting the desire to do any of that, it doesn't come easy to me. But I had it was Friday, actually. I went to my local game store, Battleground Games and Hobbies, in Plainville. My wife had a friend over to watch an episode of The Walking Dead. So I decided, you know, I'd head out and give them some girl time together. And I went off and I painted for a while everyone else was playing Friday Night Magic. So it was good. I got to work on some of my BMW motorcycles. I'm working on a mid-war Panzer company, and it's kind of interesting because I'm painting them in an early war scheme. They're all, you know, the early war kind of gray, and I figured that would be easier to paint, and if I could actually accomplish something, I would feel motivated to continue on and hopefully get everything painted. So these bikes are for my scout squadron, and I had been working on those. And then while I was there, I actually picked up the new Eastern Front Army book. I had the Ostfront Army book, and I was told that that's out of date, and I guess you can't use it anymore. It's not like turning legal or whatever. So I had to order this, and I was kind of disappointed with the new price hike. It was $50 for the book, and I thought that was a bit high, actually.
The only rule set I have for Flames of War came with the intro box set that I originally saw, I think, on the Beasts of War YouTube channel, and then I don't know, I was interested. I'm interested in late war. I have a late war panzer company myself. And I bought the box set, which gives you a small, very similar actually to the Warhammer 40,000 rule book that you get in their box set. I mean, similar kind of size and shape. And then I also bought the Fortress Europa book, which gives the various rules, although no SS rules. But yeah, it gives the kind of late war panzer rules. Do you think that a panzer company is the easiest and cheapest way to get into Flames of War?
Oh, I think if you use a tank company or something, heavily armored or heavily motorized, you're going to have a lot fewer models. And although they're going to cost a little bit more per model, especially if you have to buy them by the blister, because you're only getting one tank per, little plastic blister as opposed to a box of five or six. But even taking that into account, I think you're going to spend less money in the long term. I think you're going to have pack a bigger punch in the games. But it kind of has a negative side, at least with the Germans. It seems that most people who play a German force play some sort of mid or late war panzer company. They see the tanks, or they just get really excited. So whether it's panzers, or they're using panthers, or the Tiger company, I guess you can use now too. People seem to go for that. But I think it would be very affordable, especially if you try some sort of online retailers, or if your local store is doing like a reward program. That gives you, the store near me gets 10% off for every $100 you spend, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I went with the box sets. I picked up a Panther platoon, Panzer platoon, and a Stug platoon because I thought that gave me basically enough points initially. And also, the other army that I'm looking at is probably some kind of UK or sorry, I should say British mechanized. But I have a question with regards to your painting. Are you actually using the Flames of War spray base coat and then their paints, or are you using your own paints?
I'm doing a little bit of both. I've had the models since the game came out, and I've gone through several versions of rule books and army books because I got into it back in what they're calling version one, I guess. So my original rule book, for example, was the big original one, and then I was able to trade that in for the new version two, but it was the mini one that you get in that open fire, I think is what they call it, the
Certainly,
starter
yeah.
set. So my paints, I've had paints going back, for ages, but eventually they dry out. The ones I've been using were the Games Workshop paints, just
Oh, okay.
because that's what's most accessible for here. I would prefer to use the Vallejo paints, but all of my Vallejos are either missing or dried out. So I actually I had a bit of a problem getting my hands on some more. In the podcast I released last night, I had talked about this a little bit, and I actually did a lot more legwork today because it turns out that paints that I had ordered are now out of stock and very hard to get. So another local store is trying to get one of the box sets for me. I think Vallejo worked with Battlefront to release paint sets for, engineered with like a theme. The one I've been looking for is a German infantry paint set, but they have like a British paint set and all that kind of stuff.
I picked up the quartermasters, and I think I have somewhere. Sorry, my library is also my paint room. I picked up the German armor paint set recently as well to kind of finish off the armor that I'd already bought. I'm looking at the rules. We talked a little bit about in Stone Ape about how I read rules and how I kind of play them through in my head. I think the real weakness with regards to the Panzer Company is just a diversity of troop types and certainly an ability to react against particular other kinds of troop types, airplanes, for example. aircraft, and also various kinds of, I guess, infantry maneuvers, and also the fact that you have such a high points density in these vehicles, which can become bogged or, you know, unable to move and these kind of things. You're putting in BMW bike platoon. What else are you putting together to kind of offset the tank nature of the Panzer Army?
Unfortunately, the standard for play is 1,500 points for tournaments. So as you had said, the tanks take up a lot of points. They're a huge point sink. And that doesn't really leave much to play with elsewise. I actually didn't want to have a Scout platoon. I wanted to go ahead and use a Panzer Pioneer platoon. They allow you to have the Panzernacker, and that would give it a little bit of, you know, offensive punch from my infantry. Plus, they would also help me find ambushes and all the things that the scouts would. Additionally, I also put in a Panzer Grenadier platoon, and again, that was a concession to the points issue. I wanted to use an armored Panzer Grenadier platoon, and the points for those, because of the half tracks, they're just so much more than it is to put them in some trucks. But the downside is, by having a motorized Panzer Grenadier platoon, I have to move up in trucks, then dismount, and then go on foot. I can't, you know, actually get anywhere close to combat inside these trucks, or they're going to blow up, and I might suffer casualties as a result.
Yes, it's a funny force, because you really do have these kind of problems, even with, in terms of the armies that you've seen actually play at your local stores, do you get a sense of what the optimal list would be, or do you just think that there are always going to be certain weaknesses? I mean, for example, what does your army do with regards to aircraft? I mean, enemy aircraft fire.
I'm assuming not a whole lot. I've only played two games so far. They were 600-point introductory games. And again, with the points issue for that, all I was able to field was my HQ, one combat platoon of three Panzer IIIs, and a scout platoon of the HQ and one scout bike to accompany it. So that didn't really allow me to do a whole lot. And those two games I faced against a Russian force, and I'm trying to think what exactly it was. They had some T-34s, I think, and then a whole slew of infantry. I know the Russians, they cost a lot fewer points because they're, in theory, not as good, so they're overwhelming you. But the Russian tanks had a longer range for their weaponry, and that just played havoc with my Panzers. Luckily, he didn't have any air support, so I didn't have to come up against that. But I've seen air support play a huge role, and sometimes not a huge role, in other games. It would look to me like an optimal force, though, would be a Panzer Grenadier company. You have the better infantry. You have a really good support system of different types of tanks, so you can have heavy tanks like Tigers. You could have Panzers to support you, or Panthers. Plus, you have your mortars. You have your heavy artillery. And everything is much cheaper to get. And if you need more anti-air, you have that, or you can use your extra aircraft or whatever. But it seems to be the most versatile. And one of the people who play locally and another member have gone to Flames of War tournaments. And this one person in particular has gone, and I think he's gotten into the Nationals for Flames of War here in the United States. And he plays with the Panzer Grenadier Company. And, I mean, he plays it expertly. But even so, it allows him to use almost a little bit of anything, so he's well adapted to all situations.
Yes, and I guess starting the way we both are with tanks predominantly, we could move in that direction relatively easily. I mean, that was certainly a thing that I considered when I bought the platoon boxes, was a sense that, you know, if I wanted to expand in different directions, I certainly had the option to use a majority of the models that I'd already purchased, no matter what direction I went in.
It does seem like a good way to go, and I think you mentioning that your other army might be a British motorized force seems to kind of make sense. It's almost doing kind of what you've done with your Germans, but slightly different.
Yeah, I think the thing with the British is that they're just more eclectic, and certainly I would put in some kind of air support and probably just a different army. I mean, I really like the Cromwell Mark IIIs, rather, and I think... I'm very much an aesthetic gamer in that regard. if I like the look of the models, then I will justify basically creating even a non-existent or super weak force just so I can get the beautiful miniatures that I want to paint or collect or what have you. So yeah, I remember you doing some early CWF gamecasts where you discussed this phenomenon as well.
Yeah, I think there seems to be very few types of gamers in that some people who may or may not end up becoming power gamers go for what's going to pack the most punch. What am I going to be able to do the most damage with? What's going to have the best cost effectiveness? Other people like just the look of the models. And then other people, and I think this is where I fall in, really fall in love with a theme. Or, you know, there's some sort of other story that drives them to do what they do. I have a friend who plays 40K, and he reads a lot of the fiction that comes out in the Black Library. So he plays, you know, an Ultramarines force right now, but he's painted them and themed them after some special company, Fifth Company or something, I think, that's appeared in several, I think, of the Black Library books. But he almost never wins. And it's true. I mean, he knows the rules. He knows how to play. But he's not playing with – he hopes to win, but he's not playing with the main purpose of winning. He's playing to show off what he's done with assembling and painting, and because it's a force that he really loves the story for. So he, you know, envisions himself on the battlefield with all the Space Marines hacking away at the Chaos Space Marines and the mutants and the all the weird people and demons and stuff. And so he sees himself there. He doesn't care that maybe he'd be better off playing a different force and taking, you know, unit choice B over unit choice A because you have a higher probability of hitting things. And he cares about whether they look good, but that's far less important to him than the story behind them.
Yes, yes. Speak of narrative, I know we're a little stretched for time, but I wanted to talk a little bit about your D&D games. You're playing 4th edition currently.
Yes, this is my first chance learning how to play Dungeons & Dragons, and I've kind of surprised myself that I haven't played that before. It's all over the place, and all my friends have been playing for, well, as long as I can remember. But I never really seem to have been interested in it, and something about 4th Ed kind of struck a chord with me because I play World of Warcraft, and in a lot of ways it kind of reminds me of World of Warcraft, but with pen and paper. Right now we're playing in a homegrown campaign. Our DM is a police officer in a neighboring town, and he could actually write books, great fantasy novels based on the campaigns that he runs. They're so full of storyline and very evocative of feel and setting. Some of his stuff, he takes something that may be pre-existing and then modifies it, but most of it, he starts from scratch. And we've been playing for over a year now. We only play once a month, but it's a lot of fun. We have a good group, and it's changed a little bit from who's been in it, and some people have had to drop out and everything. But it's a really good learning situation to learn a new set of rules and to kind of expand your one's writing capabilities. You have to be very creative, I think, to figure out what you need to do and go about it. Although it's very combat-centric, it still has a lot of room for actual role-playing.
Yes, yeah. It's certainly a particular skill set to be a good DM or GM or, I mean, whatever the generic term may be in the role-playing game that is being played. When you say you play only once a month, do you play for a long... I mean, do you play for 3, 4, 5 hours at that once-a-month game?
We don't play for as long as I or as others in the group would like. We play at a local store, Battleground Games and Hobbies, but we play at their Abington location. And officially we're supposed to start at 6:30 or 7, but by the time all of us get out of work, some of us don't get there until much later. Myself, I live about 45 minutes to an hour away, so by the time I get out of work, commute home a half hour, change, eat, get all my stuff and get there, I probably don't get there until 7:30. So some people have been there for a little while. And then there's another member who gets out of work around 7 or 7:30, and then he drives like 10 minutes down the road to get there. And then we end up calling it a night by like 9 or 10. One of our members works, I'm not really sure, he's like a masonry assistant, I guess. So he's up at 4 or 5 in the morning and at the job site by 6. So late nights don't really happen. I've been hoping we could maybe do some weekends or, you know, days off to do like a nice marathon session, get in like 6 or 7 hours of gaming. But it hasn't worked out that way yet.
Yeah, it's interesting, actually. I mean, my background with D&D in particular came through, I guess, the basic box set, which was... you were born in 1981, weren't you?
Yep, this is 1981.
Okay, so that probably came out around 1982. And I haven't really, as I said in our Stone Ape recording, I haven't really done any role-playing since I was probably about 14, 15. But I still maintain the books. I gave away a lot of books to an ex-girlfriend's brother when I was about 17, thinking, oh, yes, I'll never need them again. But I've repurchased a lot of those either through secondhand bookstores or on eBay. And I do maintain the rule sets from that period just as a point of interest. With the new basic box set that came out recently, it sold for like $19 or $20. And I picked a copy up at Borders, just amazed that it was that price. I can't remember what the original was. I think it was given to me as a birthday gift. But I have the original basic rules and also the expert rules. And they're completely different to the, well, at least what was in the basic box set more recently. The thing that struck me by buying the most recent box set was just the number of cards. And certainly the original didn't come with any cards. It was very heavily reliant on dice that you coloured in, actually. They came with box of crayons. So you got these dice and then coloured in the various numbers with crayons. And for me, it was more a social thing. I had a group of friends who were very much into it, and one friend in particular kind of moved down the Warhammer fantasy roleplay route, and then we got into miniatures through that. But no, I still maintain all those old books. The newer stuff I thumb through, but the aesthetic is very different. I recorded a YouTube video a while back talking about how the Warhammer fantasy roleplay, in particular, the aesthetic and the whole game actually has changed quite dramatically. I like very kind of dark, murky, kind of underworld fantasy elements, and I think that really gelled with my time in the UK. And a lot of the brighter, full-colour kind of pictures, I don't know, relatively larger font, less text per page, role-playing elements really isn't my thing. But looking back at the old books, they're all in kind of Helvetica or Arial, probably about 9-point font, just absolutely packed, 2-paragraph, lots and lots and lots of detail. I mean, Gary Gygax in particular was a really kind of a world creator in terms of his thinking and the conciseness of his writing. And I find, as I said in our Stone Ape recording, it's a pleasure now even to go back and look at those old role-playing books, because they're so well-written and so well laid out that it really is a pleasure. Do you get a sense that you may start up your own group, or is this Games Master so enthralling that you can't imagine playing with another group of people?
Oh, I wouldn't have a problem playing with another group, but he is so fantastic. He really is a driving force for not only why the group has continued for as long as it has, but why our adventures are as good as they are. He manages to take just about anything in stride, is very well prepared for it, and comes up with interesting ways for us to move on and how to link everything. One thing I think is really interesting is that the new version, as you, I think, kind of alluded to, is more dependent on visual aids and less so on just describing what you see and what's going on around you. It seems that it works very well hand-in-hand with the D&D Minis game. So our DM actually has, as far as I know, almost all of the D&D Minis, and he places, you know, whatever the appropriate mini is or as close as he can get to represent the monsters we're facing on the battle map that he has. And I think that actually helps, especially nowadays, it seems a lot more people are visual learners, and having something described to them that, you know, you're facing a 5-foot-tall humanoid monster that's snarling at you may not convey exactly what they need to know in order to get into their role and to respond to it. But seeing it on the field lets them actually see, well, not only is this what it is, but I can see it, so I can then do, you know, certain actions, or I can't see it, and then I'm going to go do something else. So if I'm not able to engage in combat, maybe I need to go help someone stabilize because they're dying over here, or maybe I need to start investigating or working my way around to get a flank shot or something. That's one thing I think it's that was kind of missing in early editions. But at the same time, I was a big fan of the edition 3.5 and third edition rule books because the look and feel of them made me think of something that you'd actually see in game. So buying one of those books was just like your character coming across one or buying one in a shop. Whereas the books now, I think, are very pared down, and I think they may be a response to a perceived or a real lack of attention span by gamers. And I know very few people who would want to sit down and read, you know, a 400-page rule book or a new handbook out about some races or what's going on. But if it's less dense and if it's easier to kind of just peruse and look up stuff, more like a reference source, I think they'd be more willing to spend the money and get their hands on it.
Yeah, that's disappointing to hear, Jonathan, because, I mean, certainly my interest in writing this role-playing game rule set was based solely on the fact that I thought if anyone is going to actually buy a 400-page rule book, read it from cover to cover, and actually start embodying the elements or at least really passionately thinking on it. I should also point out that this rule set that I'm writing is based on a book that I'm going to have out either, well, my hope is probably just before the end of this year. So this rule set is very much based around a world, an environment, a set of ideas that I'm very familiar with. So really the reason of creating a role-playing game rule set was to, I don't know, embody the fictional writing in something that people could kind of get into the mythology and the depth of it a lot more. So my hope in doing this was that there were still people out there who would actually read a 100-page rule book and actually get something out of that. I do agree with you. I think the style of the current stuff is very much about trying to, maximize the possible readership. And I think they've actually lost the element to the fact that, as you described on the Stone Ape recording, that the kind of folk that are going to be in a role-playing environment, whether they're in a game store or in a local library or in someone's home, playing these kind of games are probably already relatively literate, relatively obsessive, and probably maybe good narrators too. I mean, I think what interests me, the notion of using miniatures in role-playing, when I was growing up, they were very, well, I mean, they were relatively expensive for me as a school student. Even after, you know, doing various summer jobs and things like that, the cost of miniatures, because they were lead and they wouldn't ship them into Australia from the UK or the US. They actually flew them in, which gave them even more expense. Mm. And I think there could have been a local community that could have cast their own miniatures as well. And certainly when I got to the UK, I got interested in that community too. But so the only people I knew who would do role-playing with miniatures were adults that had reasonable income, and it was really quite a distinction that we would have these books that were the books were relatively expensive as well, but they weren't as expensive as the miniatures. So the people that had miniatures for role-playing in particular were typically adult role-players rather than the kind of people I grew up with. We did eventually get into miniatures, and certainly very much into kind of Warhammer Fantasy in particular, and also some 40K. But a lot of that came through purchasing these adult role players or adult miniature gamers' armies, armies that they were no longer interested in. So, for example, the first army that I ever purchased was a squat army in 40K, which is kind of space dwarves army, which, ironically, I gave on to this ex-girlfriend's brother.
Oh, no.
When I was 17, and the decision that I was never going to have anything more to do with any of this stuff, so I might as well pass it on to this fellow. Looking back now, looking at the amount that squat armies go for on eBay,
mm-hmm.
Not a particularly wise decision. I have been able to purchase some squats, but I'm still looking for the Fidel Castro squat and I know he's out there for me, but he will eventually reoccur on eBay. I have seen one in the past 2 years appear on eBay, but he didn't have any, he didn't have like the base leg part, and I thought I could probably wait until another one appeared. But also, what other armies did I buy? I never had a full fantasy army properly. I had various piecemeal components of fantasy. I had various skeletons and things that could have made some kind of rambling undead army, but the Squat Army was the only full coherent army that I owned, aside from we used to get, this is classic cliche, but we used to get the Aerofix models. I'm not even sure what scale they are. I think they're probably 15mm, maybe slightly bigger, maybe 20mm actually. And I had Romans and Barbarians that I assembled with my father when I was about 6 or 7, and they continued to fight in various battles. I glued them to card and played them into my early teens. And similarly, as I described in Stone Ape, when I say a war memorial, it was actually like a war history museum, and it's a sizable museum. It's probably one of the best museums in Australia, actually. And I used to go there quite frequently as a boy and would buy, again, plastic soldiers' matchbox, actually, plastic soldiers, Germans and British and what have you, and again would glue them to card and write various rules. So that was my background with regards to miniatures. You mentioned that you had a 40K Space Marine chapter. Do you still have that, or did you pass that on?
I have all of... It's kind of sad, actually. I have all of the models I've ever purchased. So I have tens of thousands of models that are clogging the attic and basement of my parents' house. I'm sure they would love to get the space back. And my wife would love for me to sell them and us to get the money. But as I explained to her, if I did that, I would just have to rebuy them again when I start playing. And
I have to point out that not only would you rebuy them, you would buy probably maybe 10 to 15 times what you originally purchased to make up for the hole that was in your soul from selling them the first time?
Oh, absolutely. And I would spend 10 times the amount of money on it, too.
Yes.
So the fact that it would be a huge net loss persuaded both her and my parents that, one, I'm not selling them, and two, they get to live in the attic in the basement a while longer.
So you haven't considered moving them into your current place?
I would love to, but we simply don't have the space. It's interesting, the apartment, it's small, and I mean, it's suitable for most of our needs, but an example of its unique limitations is that we have a separate kitchen, of course, but then we have a combination dining and living room, and the living room also happens to be the home of our two bunnies, and it's also my computer studio slash study slash painting area slash...
Certainly. Yeah, the rabbits are featured in a Stone Ape as well. So.
Yeah, I informed them that they're superstars now.
Very much so. I believe they have their own Facebook page. So do you think that you'll move some of the armies over eventually, or do you think this is going to be something where you'll go back to your parents' house in maybe 20 or 30 years and they'll still be there?
Well, our long-term goal is to move out and purchase our own house. Sadly, I don't have figures handy on this, but as far as I know, the northeast part of the United States has the highest cost of living and the most expensive area in the country to purchase a home and maintain any sort of household in. So chances of us being able to afford a house, you know, anytime very soon would be slim. But it's something we're working towards, and we know that once that happens, I'll be able to move all my gaming stuff out of my parents' place, and it would be nice to clear that empty space out for them and give them some place to put.
Yes, I'm happy to say that I have the reverse problem, that Las Vegas has some of the cheapest houses. So we were able to pick up a place that has a library, and it's not particularly spacious, but it's certainly very comfortable. And yes, I have only a cubic meter's worth of miniatures in plastic Citadel cages are squirreled away. And yes, I've had a similar conversation with my wife that there's no way I'm getting rid of them. I have, however, when we first moved here, things were rather tough, and we were living very much in a small apartment. And I did sell, I had a Games Workshop Studio Army that I picked up. I can't remember, I think just as I was leaving the UK, and I got it for an absolute song from a fellow who was joining Climax Games. So he was moving from Forge World to work at Climax, which is a electronic games company, a video games company. And I picked up an Imperial Guard army from him for an absolute song that was also themed on a board that I saw when we went to Warhammer World. And I'm sad to say that I did actually sell that army when things looked really tight when we first moved here. I don't really regret that because I do have a lot of, I mean, I have various like gold demon paint and miniatures and various other things in my collection, and that really was just a little bit excessive. But I think that's the only army that I've sold in my adult life, and it was in pretty dire circumstances, so I can probably write that one off.
I'm actually pretty happy to say I have, it's not a whole army, it's a special character in a squad of Kroot mercenaries from the Kroot mercenary army list for 40K that was painted by one of the playtesters. I think his name is C.J. Cummings, I think. And I, Lord knows I probably paid too much for it, but it's something I have on display, and I can't see myself parting with them unless, you know, I absolutely had to. But my wife and I, we were married in May, and we wanted to give each other as our wedding gift our honeymoon. So what I had done was I sold all of my Access and Allies land miniatures. I sold them to an online vendor, and I got a decent amount of money, which paid for maybe a fourth or half of our honeymoon. And that's something I don't regret at all. And I would do again if I had to. I don't know, maybe it's a little odd, but in my head, collectible minis are a little bit different from, you know, something like Flames of War Army or Games Workshop or something like that.
Yes, it's funny, actually, the kind of quality difference and also the attachment difference. I certainly feel that about a set of kind of Games Workshop metal from the late 80s, early 90s, and it is very much a period of time where I would kind of be thumbing through the White Dwarf in Australia thinking, gosh, how much money would I need to earn in order to earn this? But yeah, I do understand exactly where you're coming from. I have talked to my wife about getting various display cases and putting some of my collection out because some of it in particular I think really lends itself to being displayed. But unfortunately, even in the library, even though I can have a painting table and various, you know, various miniature-related stuff in the library, it's still pretty well dominated by her UK, China, and various other things. So I don't know. I think the gaming space is still something. I was married in 2002, so it's still something that I have to negotiate in my married life. I don't know and what I'll offer, and because yes, I guess I'm going to have to work things out. Do you play any miniature games with your wife?
I would love to. She's not a gamer, is the only way I can phrase it. She likes party kind of games. I mentioned to you on the Stone Ape podcast about zombie dice, and I was originally taught how to play that by a five-year-old, and it's a lot of fun, but it's an easy, casual kind of game you can kind of do and, you know, do with a group of people. So I taught my wife how to play that, and she likes to play that a lot with me. I've actually tried teaching our bunnies how to play, and I'll roll the dice on the ground and explain to them, and of course, you know, they don't understand what I'm saying, and then they come over and they seem interested, and then they try to eat the dice, so
yeah.
it ends there.
Have you thought about weird World War II as a way to get your wife? I mean, the whole notion of girls' night in to watch a zombie movie seems to indicate that there's a theme going here with your wife's interests. Have you thought about weird World War II as a way to kind of combine miniature games, zombies, and the Second World War?
It's interesting because she has some sort of interest in painting and perhaps assembling models, and she has a growing interest in horror films and zombies and that kind of stuff. So I purchased, what was it? It was some sort of dragon from Reaper Minis a while back, and she painted it up. And I actually have pictures up on my personal Facebook page, which no one will be able to see because I hide myself. so I'm not really sure why I even mentioned that. But every now and again, I try to get her, you know, models, and I try to see if I can trick her into painting some of my stuff for me. I think perhaps a World War II would be something that she might be into. I know through online some people who created their own company to make models for that, and they created a rule set for that theme.
Are you talking about Dark Sun Design?
No, it's called Battleground Weird War 2.
Oh, yes, okay, I know that as well, yeah.
And they've taken down that website to concentrate on their business of creating and selling miniatures, which I think their models are actually quite fantastic, considering what they've done and the unique scale that they use. I like with that you can kind of get models from just about any different type of manufacturer, so you can meet whatever needs you might have as far as availability or price. You know, just assemble them if you have to. Some of them I think might be one-piece molds, and others are multi-part kits. But then do that, and then there's no really right or wrong way to paint them. There's a general, you know, rule set to use. But, I mean, if you have a gigantic plastic dragon floating around the house, you could pop that in as some sort of demon that showed up, or, you know, a horde of zombies or whatever. And it's funny you mentioned this, too, because in the podcast I recorded yesterday, I was talking about this and the Walking Dead TV show, which is what my wife was watching. And I was musing that I'm surprised there's not, and maybe there will be soon, but that there's not a good zombie role-playing game that would allow you to not only be a human survivor, but also to be a zombie and explore what it's like to be a zombie and to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, it is an interesting genre. I mean, certainly in the weird World War II genre, I've seen German zombies and various kind of mixes of kind of post-World War II Third Reich tech and zombie-related stuff, and there are various movies about that as well. I think probably the miniature potential is out there, both with converting existing World War II and, as you say, augmenting it with other minis that would fill into that. But, certainly my experience of trying to get my wife into painting and gaming and these kind of things has never really worked out right. But, I mean, you're still relatively early in your marriage, so more power to you, and all the best in that. And maybe this could be a returning topic in terms of your ability to have success, or at least pace by pace through the potential of introducing your wife into one of your hobbies.
I remain hopeful, although the practicality is that beyond playing apples to apples, I'm not expecting a whole lot. Although she's actually a big fan of certain video games. I have a Wii, and she loves to play Mario Kart on the Wii and is quite good at it. So that might be more of her liking.
Yes. Your wife and my wife have a number of similarities by the sounds of things. Well, Jonathan, I understand it's very late where you are. It's still relatively late where I am. And I think this was probably a good introduction to the format for folks listening in. But I would encourage people who are listening in who'd like to contribute also. I mean, we're currently doing this in a kind of closed recording format, but I think there's nothing stopping other listeners from participating in a similar discussion and potentially, I don't know, getting on a call or something like that. Jonathan, how do you see this format expanding?
Oh, I think that it would be great to have not only people come on as guests in a closed format, but to open it up kind of like how you do with the Model Reel radio and allow people to call in. I've been speaking with some people to line up guests already for us, and I have two or three right now who I know definitely want to appear, whether it's just as a closed format guest or in a more open, just kind of call-in setup. But it's my goal to have people, regular gamers, and to have people who have different specialties in gaming, both here in New England and elsewhere. I'd love to have a soon-to-be CWF Gamecast staff member come on, who is co-founder of Battlefront Games. I think he'd have a really interesting say in things. And then I also would like to get some online vendors on, and some game store owners, and perhaps some convention organizers too, to kind of talk about what goes on behind the scenes and like their impact in local gaming, and just kind of flesh the world of gaming out for everyone and get a bunch of different voices involved and just see where that takes us.
Yeah, no, all of those groups would bring a completely different perspective to this discussion, and that would be wonderful. It'd be wonderful. Well, Jonathan, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to do this impromptu recording this evening, and I'm really looking forward to talking to you in the future.
Oh, absolutely. This was a lot of fun, and I can't wait for us to do our next recording.
Terrific. I'll talk to you soon, Jonathan. Take care.
Okay, you too.
The CWF Gamecast is proudly sponsored by 127games.com, home of the cheapest Access and Allies miniatures. Find them at 127games.com. Look for the CWF Gamecast online at www.wargamingforums.com. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. You can learn more about this episode by visiting the show notes on our blog. Thank you for listening, and keep on gaming.